On Point is a production of NPR and WBUR Boston. The program is made possible by your financial support. Please pledge online at WBUR.org.
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Walk down the aisles of Walmart or most any other big retailer in America, and what you already knew hits you all over again, maybe even frightens you. In aisle after aisle, the Made in the USA label is gone. But here and there, it may be creeping back for all kinds of reasons, because it's suddenly cool and comforting and maybe necessary. This hour, On Point, products made in the USA and the new American itch to bring our buying home. You can join the conversation. Do you find yourself suddenly looking out for what's made in America? Why? Joining me first today from New York is Alex Williams, a writer for the Sunday Style section of the New York Times. Alex, thanks a lot for being with us.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for having me.
So there you were. We love the story. You open up. You were out talking to the director of the Sierra Club in Sacramento, who was saying, you know, he used to think people who looked for a Made in the USA label were everything he was not: flag waving, protectionist, and even xenophobic. Now he says he's becoming one of them. One example, but why?
Well, I think that all sorts of things that people in his political affiliation are starting to think about are coming to a head, basically. I mean, you've got fair trade issues, you've got sort of an extension of the buy local movement in food, which is logically being extended to other products, whether it's bicycles or toys. And I think the big wake-up call here was the outcry over the recalls of Chinese toys and pet food, which was a point where a lot of people who never considered themselves protectionists at all were starting to think about not only avoiding Chinese things because they couldn't, you know, they didn't think they could trust the quality, but, you know, thinking about buying alternatives, American alternatives, so they could trust them more.
It's not as if, you know, buy American is a new theme. I mean, in the 80s, it was gigantic. Lots of people talked about it all the time, particularly when it came to big ticket items, cars and all the rest. What's new about it this time?
Well, it was very big. You're right. I think they hit its high water mark in the early 80s with in Detroit, coming out of the, you know, Lee Iacocca years with rescuing Chrysler, and it was a big movement. But it's waned in recent years, and I think I don't think a lot of people on either side of the political fence were ever hostile to the notion, but it just never seemed like a priority. And a lot of the people, I think, certainly during the Clinton years, a lot of affluent liberals, if you would, became big free traders, and it just never seemed, you know, this whole sort of internationalist approach seemed much more of the moment. To say buy America just seems sort of narrow-minded and almost myopic.
But now there's this checklist, and it's not a short one. I mean, right at the top, hearings in Congress yesterday on safety of products from China, the stories about poisoned toys and lead and tainted food and all the rest. I mean, just when it comes to personal safety, there's something right there as a checkbox.
Oh, that's absolutely true. I mean, there's personal safety. There are a lot of issues. I mean, I think there's a growing unease about fair trade issues and labor practices in China. And I think there's also a real...
So when you buy a Chinese product, what kind of labor conditions are you supporting?
Absolutely, mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, we have no idea. Not just China, of course, but that seems like 75% of what we buy now is made in China.
Or Bangladesh or Vietnam or really almost any corner of the world these days.
Absolutely. And we're talking about iconic products. I mean, we're not just talking about, you know, hammers and that sort of thing in Walmart. We're talking about Levi's 501 jeans are made in Mexico and Converse Chuck Taylors, you know, these iconic American products, those are made in China now. There's all of a sudden a moment where people are waking up and they're saying, wow, you know, this is something that we all shared is being lost.
So product safety, labor conditions, buy local, so the products don't have to be shipped 10,000 miles to get to your closet or your refrigerator. And then there are those images of environmental degradation in some industrializing countries abroad. Lord knows we've had enough of that of our own, but is that turning people's heads these days?
I think that definitely is a factor. I mean, it's people, especially within the green movement, are starting to know that a certain percentage of the air pollution in Los Angeles is coming from China. And certainly the imagery, I mean, anybody who's visited China knows that it's like Dickensian London. It's, it's an environmental nightmare. And only, that's only really kicking off once they start building more coal plants. And so I think that, yeah, there's a real sense that, you know, China's becoming a green nightmare, and how much do we want to subsidize that with our own dollars?
So there's a kind of do-good element to this. There's a labor element looking at what people are getting there and what people hope they get here. There's also just a straight-up new sort of cachet around this, a kind of status around Buy American that you found, Alex. Describe that for us.
Yeah, I think there really is. I mean, part of it is just a simple matter of mathematics. As fewer and fewer products are made here, those that are still made here are rare and by definition almost sort of premium. I mean, I think a good example is Levi's jeans, which make almost all of their jeans, you know, classic American product, abroad, but their new Capital Lee brand, which is their premium hand-sewn brand, which costs $200, are made in the U.S., and there's a sense that, you know, for certain products, quality control is better. America, the Made in the USA label, is always, it's going from sort of a lunch pail chic thing to almost a marker of status or of a premium good. You see this in bicycles also, where any bike under about $700 is made abroad, mostly in China. But the really good, you know, the Treks and the Cannondales, the really premium mountain bikes, for instance, are made here, and these can be $3,000 items. And people are willing to pay for the Made in America because they think it means better components.
And for that matter, guitars too. Fender, the guitar maker, has held out on its top-of-the-line model.
It has. I mean, that's a classic example. Everything they make under about $600 is all made abroad, mostly in Mexico, but all their good stuff, their custom shop guitars, which are their, you know, their fine sort of musician quality pieces, are made in Corona, California.
This has not been lost on designers and marketers. I mean, you described some who, you know, are actually now really taking care with the label itself. They want the label to pop out and look special. They want people to know Made in the USA.
Absolutely. I mean, I think Dove Charney from American Apparel, say what you will about him, but I think he was the first person to really sense this coming. And I mean, if you look at his...
This is the guy who makes his T-shirts in downtown L.A. and says so right in every product.
He says it proudly, yeah, American Apparel. It's written right into the name. It's written into every T-shirt. And that's a big part of their corporate identity. And I mean, you know, a T-shirt's a T-shirt, but the real value added there is it's an American thing, and it is very fair trade-oriented. I mean, he pays his workers a living wage and offers them free massages, and, you know, he's made that a central core of his marketing. And I think people notice. And the interesting thing is that he's not selling to, you know, the Pat Buchananites of the world. He's not selling to, you know, the real flag wavers. He's selling to basically, you know, young urban tastemakers.
And I'm sure real flag wavers are happy to buy that as well. I mean, lest we get lost in the sudden hipness of this, I mean, the numbers are still very stark. Just look at his neck of the woods, apparel. I mean, 2001 to 2006, clothing production in the U.S. down by 56%. And that after years and years of decline already. So it's not as though there's a new boom in American-made stuff.
No, there's certainly not. I mean, I think a lot of this, as I said, I think this is a wake-up moment that all of a sudden just factories are closing. Seven, 8 years ago, you could find so many more American products than you can now. No matter what your political affiliation is, it's a bit spooky.
Alex Williams, thanks for catching that wave for us. We're going to spend some time looking at it. We appreciate you rolling it out for us.
Terrific. Thank you very much.
Alex Williams with the Style section of the New York Times joined us there from New York. Right now from Arlington, Virginia, we're joined by Stephanie Sanzone. She's creator and webmaster of StillMadeInTheUSA.com. Stephanie, thanks very much for being with us.
Hi, Tom. Nice to be here.
Okay, I see here that you've got a background in environmental science. You're working on a PhD in environmental policy. So is that what got you interested in what's still made in this country? And is it really so much better for a green earth if it's made in the USA versus somewhere else?
Well, you know, it's funny because I don't think that's really why I started it. It was more just as a shopper, realizing that many times I would go out looking and I could not find anything made in the USA. And I was worried about, you know, all the textile mills closing because I went to school in South Carolina, mm-hmm. you know, years ago. And my corner of southwestern Virginia, the furniture companies were suffering and just take any train ride pretty much and you go through areas and you see all these closed factories. And I think it was more the human element that got me going. But, you know, as I began working on the site and as you pointed out at the top of the show, the sort of list of reasons for why to care about this just kept getting longer. And because of my environmental background, I did start to realize that this was maybe part of the answer. You know, I think for years we had this feeling that it was a choice of environment or economy. And I think more people are starting to realize that that's sort of a false choice. You know, you need jobs, but you also don't want to soil your nest. And so I did start paying more attention to the fact that the environmental regulations that I've, you know, supported, obviously having put in place, they have affected the price of products.
Of American products that follow American those regulations. Yeah.
Right. And so I think, you know, as a person who worries about the environment, I started to realize even more I have a duty to support these companies. I'm trying to hold them to certain standards for emissions and product quality, and I care about worker safety and, you know, a lot of the things that we've worked hard in this country to achieve. And if, in fact, it means the product price goes up because some of that's included, I'm breaking the deal if I then turn around and say, well, I wanted you to do all those things, but I don't want to pay for that, so I'm going to buy something that's made elsewhere that's cheaper because they're not worrying about any of those things. So, I guess the short answer is it's a very complicated set of reasons for why I started the site.
We'll come back and look at the list of what you found there, but give us a hint and a heads up. Did you find anything to buy made in the USA? Anything? Enough? Something?
Well, that was the funny thing. When I started off to do this, a lot of my friends said, oh, it'll be a really small site, you know.
And short list.
I think when I started the site, I had about 200 listings, and I checked quickly last night. I think I have about 400 now.
We're talking this hour about products made in the USA and the new American itch to bring our buying home. Hearings yesterday before the Senate Appropriations Subcommittee on Financial Services and General Government looking at safety of products coming from China. Here's Senator Sam Brownback laying into Made in China.
Made in China has now become a warning label. This is about, you know, the safety of the children, the safety of the consumers, the safety in pets in this country. And we could just have zero tolerance, and I think we need to start pulling the club out.
Yeah, maybe, but we buy by the hundreds of billions from China. At the edges, maybe there's a little turnaround. We've been talking with Stephanie Sansone. She got interested in buying American not so long ago, put up a website called stillmadeinusa.com to see what was out there. And what did you find, Stephanie, when you took a look?
Well, I think when I first started looking, mostly what I had were apparel listings and a few toys and, a few other categories. I think I started off with 6 or 7 categories. But the things that were not there was what surprised me the most. And
like?
A lot of that was, well, you know, as a parent, I know at this point I cannot buy a child's bike that is made here.
Schwinn Lots and Huffy
things.
Both have gone off to Asia, though the higher-end Trek, you know, Cannondale's still here. Trek, yeah.
Well, yeah, but I mean, you're not going to get a Trek bike for your,
right,
you know, your toddler.
Right.
So, I mean, that's what I'm saying. It's true that there are some of these very upscale products that are still made for, I would say, pretty custom niche markets. But as a parent, you know, I need to go off to the store and I need to be able to buy enough clothes to last the week, and I need things for my household. I can't get an iron that's made here anymore. There's no such thing as a U.S.-made toaster. There's practically not such a thing as a U.S.-made vacuum cleaner.
Mm.
There are no sewing machines made in the U.S. So the more I looked, the more I'd say almost horrified I was. I didn't realize how bad it had gotten. I knew that clothing and towels and sheets and things, you had to really look hard. But it has gotten harder even since I started the site a few years ago.
So there may be an appetite, not so easy to satisfy it. What about your friends, neighbors, people you know? Do you find them more interested in Made in America these days? And does it just seem like a passing fad straight off the poison toys headlines or something deeper?
Well, I mean, one thing I did notice, I had a fairly steady stream of people that were using my site, and they would tell me why. And mostly it was because something had happened in their personal life that sort of gave them a wake-up call. You know, their fiance lost her job, or because of a company moving their production elsewhere, or, you know, something that was very close to them where suddenly they realized this is really happening. It's not just news headlines about loss of manufacturing jobs and things. But the recent surge of people using my site, and this is one of the things I had talked to Alex Williams about, was I really did notice a shift in the kinds of folks that were coming to my site. They really were looking for toys, and suddenly that became the one of the top search phrases was toys made in
right.
USA, and there were lots of what I call mommy boards and, you know, sort of parenting discussion boards that were talking about this issue, and it really was, I think, a totally different set of people who probably hadn't thought much about where things were made, but all of a sudden this was directly in their home and it affected the safety of their children, and people were very upset. So I did definitely have seen a surge in people looking for American-made toys. I don't know how much that carries over, though, into other categories. That remains to be seen.
Well, let's look. There's a surge of a sort, and you can feel it, the interest in the Made in the USA label, its new kind of cachet, and lots of reasons for it. Stephanie Sansone, please stand by. I want to welcome into our conversation as well today from Arlington, Virginia, there in the studio with you, Jared Bernstein, senior economist at the Economic Policy Institute, author of All Together Now, Common Sense for a Fair Economy. Jared Bernstein, thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you for inviting me, Tom.
So we know what the big numbers look like. At the same time, you've got this kind of hot interest around Made in America. But remind us just how big that tidal wave of products heading in here every day is compared to what people are buying that's made in the USA.
Right. I certainly don't want to pour cool water on what I agree with you is a hot discussion and may well be the cusp of an important new trend. But if Made in China is a warning label, it's a warning label that we are not heeding writ large. Last year, we had a trade deficit with China of well over $200 billion. That means we bought a lot more from them than they bought from us. And if you look at the statistics for the whole for all the countries we trade with, we imported a big number, $2.3 trillion of goods last year, and we exported $1.6 trillion. The difference, about $700 billion, it's about 6%+ of GDP. That's a big chunk of our economy. That's the trade deficit. Now, I don't think anyone in this discussion is suggesting that the magnitude of this Made in USA idea is really that far beyond a niche so far, and it could of course become greater than that. But I think that's probably the right way to characterize this when you look at the context of imports and exports, just how much more trade is going on, how much more globalization is part of every consumer's life now.
Is this just some kind of, throwback nostalgia, Jared Bernstein? Suddenly people wishing it was made closer to home, wishing American hands and some standards and maybe even idealized standards had been on it? Or is this something futuristic?
Reading Alex's article, listening to the discussion so far, there's two things going on. And I think one of those things is, well, you might call it nostalgic, but I guess I would call it more a reaction to the kinds of things that got Stephanie interested in this that people are aware of. That is the extent to which this large trade deficit, and I just gave you 2006, but that's been going on for 10 years.
Year after year after year.
Year after year. The extent to which that's playing out in our communities, in our labor market, in our wages and incomes. And by the way, I'm a big booster for the upside of globalization, which tends to come in the form of lower prices. Mm-hmm. But people are more aware now than ever of the downsides, and you heard some of those articulated. So that's part of it. But the other part, which I don't think was nearly had as much to do with the older Made in USA movement, has to do with issues of safety. That's big and that's new, and that's one of the reasons I think this is a potentially big story that we're just seeing the very beginning of. I mean, if especially affluent people who can afford to spend more on things like toys and food believe that their kids' safety is at risk, well, of course they're going to do so. And so that seems to me to only be getting larger.
We'll look more at the big picture. We've got a lot of listeners who want to join us. Stephanie, Jared, please stand by. Nick's calling from Petersham, Massachusetts. Nick, you're on the air.
Good morning, Tom. Great show.
Thanks.
Thanks for taking my call. Yeah, we've produced plastic model kits, and we've been doing it now for 20 years.
What kind of model kits, Nick?
SS United States, White House, famous airplane.
Okay, so plastic model. Okay, model kits. Got it.
Right, and we're one of the two model companies that still makes our product in the United States.
Two, okay.
Well, one of the big changes I see is, and that wasn't the competition in price from overseas or from China, was the change in retail outlets. When I started in 1987, there were 20,745 independently owned toy and hobby stores.
Yeah.
Today, there's less than 4,000. And it wasn't so much that the larger Walmarts and Toys R Us and so much forced them out of business. It was more that banks stopped lending money to individuals to start a business.
What does it matter to you whether you're dealing with 20,000 smaller stores or 4,000 bigger ones?
oh, I can't produce my product in the United States and sell it to Walmart for what they want.
Why not?
Because they want it so cheaply.
So they've got they put the screws to you. Whoever's going to supply them, it's got to be rock bottom dollar, and you
exactly.
can't hit that.
Our White House kit cost $8 to make. They offered us $5.88.
So, but wouldn't that be the same with the smaller store? What's the difference?
Oh, no. The smaller store will pay the price it wants because it also offers service and a lot of variety.
I got it. And maybe their customers want that variety, in fact, are willing to pay a little more for it. Nick, stick with us for a second. Jared, this raises an interesting question about our actual, you know, retail distribution structure and whether at this point it works against American manufacturers.
Well, I don't think that's a question. I mean, American manufacturers have been getting slammed in areas like toys, apparel, and now automotives are obviously on the ropes as well. Look, I mean, I sit about 50 feet from one of these little toy stores in this place where the studio is, very much the type that Nick is describing. And yeah. I live in this neighborhood. And we will go to that toy store precisely for the kind of service that that Nick is describing. However, you know, a mile down the road are the big boxes with whom he competes. And, you know, we go there sometimes, too. And I see a whole lot more people in the latter than in the former. One of the things that's going on, Nick raised an absolutely relevant point. These stores squeeze their supply chains, and that has a profound effect on price, which we all know about, but it also has a profound effect on the ability of smaller manufacturers to compete. Now, they might want to compete on service, they might want to compete on quality, but for years, service and quality took second step to issues of price. I think that might be changing a little bit, certainly seems to be from the context of our conversation, but it remains a niche kind of issue.
Nick, let me ask you, do you see the sort of mega-sized retailers then as a structural impediment to you getting back in the stream? Maybe there's an American appetite for these products, but you're not going to be able to respond to it because you just don't fit into their big cookie cutter anymore.
You know, we used to fit into the middle ones, but not the larger ones. They used to always be the 67 to 85 numbered stores. And you know, each year you'd get a hit with one or two of them, and that was great. But with the larger ones, no. I mean, we're looking more for our sales to be overseas than they are in the United States now. The example of the White House kit, I sold more in Lebanon last year than I sold in the United States.
Lebanon?
Yeah, just because.
Who's buying White House kits in Lebanon? Hmm.
I know that. Yeah. Every time I make a shipment, I wonder.
You have their
that.
Names?
Oh, my gosh. Oh, my gosh. Nick, thanks for that story. Stephanie, what about it? I mean, this is interesting. What if we've built this super-duper retail, efficient retail structure, but it doesn't want to deal with American manufacturers because they cost a little more. They're not just a cookie-cutter product. Oops.
Well, actually, that's one of the points that has interested me a lot about doing the website, because the internet has been a great leveler in many respects. A lot of these manufacturers, the small ones, are able to sell direct to the public. You know, it does take staff. You have to be able to deal with orders and returns, and it's not hassle-free. But basically, if you can put up a nice website with an online store, you can get around the fact that Walmart doesn't want to carry your product at a price that you can make a profit. And so the internet has allowed smaller manufacturers and craftsmen and all sorts of folks to reach a public that they could not have reached. You know, you can be national or international by having a website. And that's one of the things that I find so fun about stillmadeinusa.com is I'm sort of a virtual store. I'm bringing together all of these small sites, and I need to, you know, find out Nick, where his company is, get him on the site. But that's part of what's fun about having an internet shopping experience is you're not letting Walmart or some other retailer decide what products you see.
I just want to inject one point. You know, one thing, we've been talking about this from the perspective of the retailer, someone like Nick. Think about this also from the perspective of the consumer, many of whom, and it's basically about the bottom half of the income scale, have seen their income stagnate over the last 10 years and even longer for other groups. Now, for those folks, a pair of jeans, a premium brand pair of jeans that costs $200 is absolutely out of reach.
Yep.
So we also have to recognize the income constraints that so many folks are we're facing that are very much complementary to the rise of cheap imported goods.
Let's take a call from Tony in Boston. Hi, Tony. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. How are you? Thanks for taking my call.
Yeah.
I think the reality is that we're focused on money. You know, in the environment, I was part of Clamshell Alliance. My family is, you know, went to jail for unions back in the 40s and 50s. So I'm all for that kind of stuff. But the reality is what's going to happen is that China is going to hire some kind of high-powered marketing firm. They're going to come in and market everything away because we're really dumb and, you know, the American consumer really is just looks what's on TV.
Well, do they really win on marketing, Tony, or do they just win on price? Because, like Nick said, they can deliver it more cheaply by and large.
Well, and that's the second thing. Mattel, the reason why they went to China is because they can make an extra 10-15%. 20% on their product and then coming from somebody from America. So you're not going to change corporate America. It's going to wait so that this thing kind of blows over. And the other thing is Tom, remember back in, I don't know how old you are, but I remember younger, if you saw something from made in Japan, it was terrible. Now, Japan, if something's made in Japan, it's a quality.
First class.
First quality. And then the beer, like, for example, from China, you get a beer from China. That bottle is as thick as the old Coke bottle. It's not the thin minimum glass that you need so that it doesn't break. So I think this is all just a blip. You know, the United States has to change their focus more towards the individual as compared to the money.
You think we're done? We're toast. We're gonna buy everything from China anyway. It's gonna have to be services. Manufacturing isn't gonna do it.
Well, look at the trends, Tom.
Yeah, no, I see them. They're huge and they're right in front of us. Jared Bernstein, you're the economist, and you point to one thing. You say, look, if a big chunk of the society doesn't have the money to shop anywhere but Walmart, then that, of course, is where they're going to go. But what about, we're told that at some point, you know, the deficit can't go on forever. The U.S. dollar's gotten lower and lower and lower. I mean, right now it's just in the cellar. Maybe there comes a time when those products aren't so cheap anymore, when our dollar's, you know, worth a couple of pennies and we've got to make it here.
You know, I'm actually less pessimistic than Tony on this point. Let me just give you one small, perhaps insignificant change that recently occurred. Imports from China are actually down significantly in the last quarter, down $6 billion. And that's actually an historically large decline. Now, we import about $75 billion over a given quarter, so that's off a small base. But and I noted the large trade deficit with China. But yes, the point you made a second ago is precisely correct. The dollar is weakening in international markets. Now, that might sound bad. Weak dollar. In fact, a weak dollar, that is a dollar that's worth less in terms of foreign currencies, is actually to our advantage when it comes to trying to sell manufacturers abroad. It helps us export more, and it makes imports a little bit more expensive. And it's the primary way in which economies adjust to unwind large unsustainable trade deficits. And like we say, unsustainable trends can't be sustained.
We're talking this hour about products made in the USA and the new American itch to bring our buying home. We've been joined today by Stephanie Sansone. She's creator and webmaster of stillmadeinusa.com, tracking what's out there from this country. Jared Bernstein joins us from the Economic Policy Institute, senior economist there, author of All Together Now and Crunch between 95 and 96. He was deputy chief economist in the U.S. Labor Department. Right now, we're going to go to Chicago. John Ratzenberger joins us. You may know him from his role as Cliff the Mailman in the long-running television series Cheers. These days, he is host of John Ratzenberger's Made in America, which airs on the Travel Channel now. On production of its fifth season. John Ratzenberger, thanks very much for being with us.
Tom, how are you?
Well, good. So what do? You go out and you look for what?
Well, for the last 5 years, we've been going around the country and really honoring the people who get up in the morning, go to work, and actually make things. I grew up in the town of Bridgeport, Connecticut, which is a factory town.
Yeah.
And that was the when I was asked to come on and produce this show. That was the incentive, because my heroes were always factory workers growing up. A lot of smart people out there who, you know, work at these jobs, and to me that's the bedrock of the foundation.
So what do you find out there, John? When you go looking for what's made in America these days, and we're told there's now an appetite for it, an itch to buy it, what's out there?
Oh, geez, Allen Edmonds shoes, Benjamin Moore paints, Cannondale bikes, Fender guitars, KitchenAid mixers. I mean, there's still a lot of things made in America. What a lot of people don't realize, I've been listening to the discussion here, mm-hmm. is you're never going to see the name of a Chinese factory on your kid's Little League uniform. And that's the bedrock, again, of the community. That's the fabric of who
you mean
we are.
They're not going to pony up to support the local Little League because they're somewhere in China.
Oh, yeah, they don't care. You know, why should they? But that's any. If you go through history, the top dog in the global scheme of things is always the country that manufactures something. And what we've been doing for the last 10 years is creating a middle class for the Chinese, and destroying our own. So at some point, they're just going to say, "Well, we're going to trade in our bikes for cars now because we've got the population. We don't need you anymore."
John, so we hear your attitude on it loud and clear. When you go out and you find that some of the brands you mentioned and the manufacturers you mentioned, is it generally high-end products? Has all the lower-cost stuff gone to China? Is this now kind of an affluent game, buying in America? American is a kind of a chic statement, you know, of, well, I can afford it, so I buy American.
No, when you go through a town, whether it's on a train, bus, car, when you fly into an airport and you look down and you see all these little manufacturers, there's people who manufacture things like nuts and bolts, shoelaces, those little things that really hold it all together. And also, you know, the other crisis that we're facing is the fact that we've canceled shop courses nationwide. We've got this idea.
I mean, industrial arts, the old industrial education
correct.
Line.
And
yep.
We got this idea that everyone wants or needs to go to college, which just isn't the fact. I mean,
but isn't it sort of criminal to educate somebody to do a tool and die if there's no tool and die to be done?
Well, exactly. See, the manual arts to me always take precedence over the fine arts, and I know that'll get a reaction from your audience, but it's true. See, somebody had to build a ceiling before Michelangelo could go to work. Someone's got to make the guitar before Bruce Springsteen can go up on stage.
Can't argue with that.
Everything is based on manufacturing. Everything that we do.
Well, someone's got to build it, but we've been told for years services might come in here too. John, Stephanie,
what does that mean?
What does that mean?
Yeah, what does it mean? Because everybody says we're going to be a service economy. What does that mean?
We've got a lot of experience in what that means and doesn't mean now, don't we? I mean, it means a lot of factory jobs are gone, and some of those entry positions that don't take so much education are gone with them, and a lot of those services jobs aren't so great, but millions of Americans do work in services now.
And what are those services? That's what I mean. That's what
well, it's everything from McDonald's to, hundreds of millions a year investment bankers, I guess.
Okay, so the investment bankers and the McDonald's people, they still rely on manufacturing in this country because if people are out of work, you know, once a factory closes down, your local pizza place closes down, your tire repair, the hardware stores, now who's going to be going into McDonald's? And these investment bankers, who are they going to be getting investment from? You know, not the small investors.
Yeah, no, we hear you. We're looking at what's underneath that label and what still gets made. Let me take a call from industrial territory, Michigan, East Lansing, Michigan. Sandra is calling. Sandra, you're on the air.
Oh, hi. Hi, Tom.
Hi.
Hi from Herman Miller country, the great state of Michigan.
Herman Miller as in furniture maker.
As in
chairs.
Furniture. And basically, you know, I was thinking, looking back, and I know when I grew up, there was always this thing about, oh, made in America, you know, lack of sophistication, and everybody was going for the Scandinavian or the Italian.
Certain people looking down their nose at the made in America product.
Right.
And people who have grease under their fingernails, yeah.
Right, right. When all along we had people like Charles Ames and George Nelson and Paul McCobb and all the great American designers. And if you look at design magazines around the world, you know, it's hard to pick up one that doesn't have a Charles Ames chair in it or something American.
So do you think that can come back, Sandra, or is it just going to be American designers shipping their designs off to China to be built?
Well, what I think, and looking at Herman Miller as a great model, I think that the resurgence we see of the interest in 60s and 60s furniture and auction houses is specialize in the 60s. I think it's we're getting back to that interest in American design, and you know it's being recognized by this new generation of young people, and I think it's the same people that are interested in the organic food, the same people that are manning the internet websites.
And it's funny because it's not a connection you might have made not so long ago. Those sort of hipsters were supposedly looking for imports. Stephanie's Center Ways is an interesting thing here. I mean, is it the hip crowd that's now looking for made in the USA?
Well, I think that's the latest entrant in it. But this raises an interesting point, which is I think when I first started building the website, I also had this idea that American made meant T-shirts and jeans and nothing very fashionable or exciting. But, you know, as you start looking around, there are some, of course, America has, like anywhere else, its share of creative and innovative people and wonderful designs and beautiful things being made. And, you know, you can posh by Tory. I have to put in a plug, my favorite purse maker down in Austin. I mean, highly stylish, wonderful things. And just to comment on this point about how much price differential there is, mm-hmm. I think in some cases we are overstating what the price premium is. A lot of these high-end products, you look at the imported, you know, look at footwear or something, you're paying quite a bit for these things. And
for
it's
imports.
Not as if...
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and it's not as if the American-made one is really that different in price. And you mentioned the issue about the $6 T-shirt from Bangladesh, mm-hmm. but you don't have to buy a $25 T-shirt to have it made in America. I mean, there are companies like Bayside Tees in California, Allure, which I don't know where they're based. You can get a very nice T-shirt for $8.50. So in many cases, I think the differential in price is not as great as we're leading ourselves to believe. Jeans is another good example.
Yeah.
We talked about luxury jeans that mm-hmm. are close to $200, but you can get American-made good work jeans for, you know, $30.
John Ratzenberger, when you're out with your camera crew on the manufacturing floor, is it price competition that they're feeling all the time, breathing down their neck?
Well, One of the big concerns is what I mentioned before is the fact that there are no children coming out of high schools with manual skills. So it's really they're really at a premium, and we're talking about not only welders but plumbers and you know people who actually can operate CNC machines, cutting machines that cut steel. Fairly simple stuff, but we've taught our kids not to work. And when's the last time you saw a paper boy on a bicycle or kids shoveling snow in the winter? For some reason.
At my house.
Well, there you go. I mean, there's sure few and far in between. But, and the other thing, the other irony that I keep thinking of is that, you know, we're sacrificing the environment for low prices. I mean, China, there was an article in the LA Times not too long ago that one-third of all of California's air pollution within 5 years will be coming from China. And I was just at the Shedd Aquarium here in Chicago, and they said, yeah, there's evidence now that the sulfur emissions from their coal smokestacks are landed in the Great Lakes. So, you know, every time we say, oh, you know, it's a little cheaper, you know, to buy something from China, well, think of the price we're paying environmentally. And I keep wondering how come the environmentalists haven't raised this issue.
Jared, let me put that to you. Do you see a green path out of this? I mean... yes, it can look pretty bad in China these days. On the other hand, American manufacturers have not historically, let's say in automobiles, have hardly historically been, you know, the world beaters when it came to building green cars. They lagged for a long time. Now they're making a push. But is that an opportunity for the U.S., or are we really not far enough out front on that? Could that be a game changer, a green push?
It is an opportunity, and we are not as far out in front of it as we need to be. I mean, John is absolutely right on this point, and it gets down to one fact, which is that we do have a lot more environmental regulations in a country like ours than in any developing economy. So you pluck a good out of their economy, it's going to be manufactured in a less environmentally friendly way than in ours, and we have a long way to go. One thing I think where we may be able to get on top of that is in the issue of carbon taxes. I mean, there's enough concern about carbon emissions from our manufacturing sector that the notion that that's the right way forward is one that even a conservative administration like this one, the Bush administration, is talking about. Europe is already there. They have carbon taxes on their manufacturers, and it's actually a very important way to dampen carbon emissions in the interest of less global warming, and it actually can be done in such a way as to really minimize any kind of distortionary effects. Can I make one other quick
Please.
Point about John? John is right on target in a lot of ways, and I just want to say there's a policy bias against what he's talking about. I would argue that for the last 20 years, people in high places have basically decided they're going to do the dirty work. That is, they're going to get the grease under their nails. By them, I mean other countries. We're going to don white lab coats and point and click our way into the future. The idea is that unions are not part of the new economy, manufacturing's not part of the new economy, and in globalization, you don't need a manufacturing sector if you're an advanced economy like ours. That's absolutely wrong for all the reasons that John and Stephanie have raised, but it's also wrong because some of the most important productivity advances in our country, technological advances, have come out of manufacturing.
And if you're not there, it's hard to be at the R&D frontier,
exactly.
I suppose. Let's
I'd
hear
like
from some more of our listeners, if I may, from Long Island, East Hampton. Susan's calling. Susan, you're on the air.
Yes, thank you
sure.
for taking my call. I think it's very important that we have products that are made in America because I think it's essential for our economy and to stay the powerhouse that we are. However, I feel that a lot of this conversation is disingenuous in the sense that we are a population of 300 million people, and yet we create 24% of the world's pollution. China has a population of 1.3 billion people, and while they're gaining on us fast, they're still second. And I think that we need to look to ourselves and what we can do as a society to be more responsible about the pollution that we create and
so clean up our own act before we beat up on China too much, but maybe greening up that act is a way to
yeah, exactly.
two birds with one stone.
Why not put tariffs on Chinese goods until they do clean up their act?
Why not clean up our own until they're more appealing? Let me get another call from...
Yeah, we have. I mean, if you look at the river running through Pittsburgh, you used to be able to develop film in it, but now you can fish out of it.
Yeah, I hear that, and yet Susan does make a point. When you look at the overall output of, greenhouse gases and the rest, we've still got the number one seat. Let me go to Bill in Beverly, Massachusetts. Bill, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I just wanted to mention the fact that being in the musical products industry, that Yamaha had made an announcement that they're moving their manufacturing of vertical pianos from Thomaston, Georgia, to China, and all their brass instruments from Michigan to China. And I really don't see a lot of domestic manufacturing in the musical products industry.
So when you look across your shelves, what have you got there? Is there anything, a harmonica, a castanet, anything made in the USA?
Well, I think somebody mentioned Fender guitars.
Yeah, so
the high-end ones, yeah.
The high-end one,
sure.
Martin guitars, Taylor guitars.
Gibson.
And, you'd find a drum workshop. A lot of high-end drum manufacturers still manufacture. Obviously, the Steinway piano is still made in New York.
Sure, yeah, in the Bronx.
Right.
But when you look at your store, Bill, do you see a future for American manufacturing, or do you see trouble?
I see a future. I think there's a niche, and I think there's a lot of artisans and craftsmen, craftspeople that manufacture violins, guitars, that it's a labor of love, and you'll always see a small niche business where a lot of upstart companies will, try to, get into the marketplace by having, made in the USA and made by hand.
Yeah, yeah.
And I think that's where the market is.
Bill, thanks very much. Jared, how big a piece of the trade deficit can that kind of market address, the made-by-hand special stuff as opposed to the mass?
I'm still trying to figure out what a vertical piano is. But,
upright as opposed
upright.
To the big grand.
Honky-tonk.
Okay, I got you. It's niche is the word right now. We have basically those kinds of products are not where the bulk of the trade deficit is. The bulk of the trade deficit is at this point in mass-produced product in automobiles and steel and not in more specialty products like a particular type of jeans or a Martin guitar. On the other hand, we have a history in our country of mass producing much of that of the same type of things we're now importing. Whether we have the capacity to get back there is an open question.
John Ratzenberger, what do you think? In our lifetimes, made in the USA dominant or even, you know, big on American shelves again or not?
Well, if we don't start reinstituting manual arts and vocational training and glorify it and stop making fun of the kids who want to be grease monkeys, then this whole conversation is moot. We won't have any manufacturing. Every industry, there's no exception to this rule, every industry came by someone inventing something. And that somebody always tinkered as a child. This is during the era that people played outdoors, climbed trees, kids were in sandboxes. That's where you learn mechanical skills and common sense.
And with that, we're out of time, but you've got to keep the training going or the people can't do it, even if you want to buy from them. John, with John Ratzenberger's Made in America, thanks for joining us. Stephanie Sansone at stillmadeinusa.com, thanks for being here. And Jared Bernstein, thanks to you. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.